Good evening, you all. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey, and this, at this time we begin the technical man. And I hear tell that we're going to have an announcement tonight as the first thing. For those who haven't heard the TechNet before, its major purpose is education. And the guys in the New York City area do this on us to educate each other as to the better ways of using ham radio. Person signs into the technical net by giving me your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. But before we take check-ins, I think we do have an announcement. Is that true? Let me turn it over to John first. KC2WGB, K2LIW TechNet. Go ahead, John.
Yes, we do, Dick. Good evening. We have Joe, W2BMP, would like to make an announcement, as he did last week, to update us on some of his information. So if you're out there, Joe, you want to pick it up, this is KC2WGB.
Good evening. Thanks very much. I just wanted to remind everybody that we're starting our general class on March 3rd. If you'd like to join that class, it is computer instructor-led. So you sit at home and you take the class from the comfort of your home. Just email me at whiskey2bravomikepapa@limark.org. And that's for the general class starting March 3rd. Thanks, guys. I appreciate it. 7-3.
And that was Joe, W2BMP, who is the educational chair, I believe, for Limark. So important. Anybody's interested, I suggest you hook up. Back to you, Dick.
Very fine, Joe. We're probably going to be hearing things that we shouldn't be hearing from time to time, and we'd like you to do us a favor. And that is, whatever you hear that you think shouldn't be there, please go to the reverse mode on your rig. In other words, listen to the input frequency, 146.25, and tell us what you hear. How strong is it? If you have a directional antenna, what direction it's coming from, and what time you heard it, and where you were located at the time. Particularly if you're mobile, that would be interesting. And indicate that to RFI@limark.org. RFI stands for Radio Frequency Interference. So give us whatever you hear and tell us, and we'd like to hear from you. Also, the net itself consists of Dick, K2RIW, John, KC2WGB, Paul, WS2N, our space expert, and quite often we hear from Hal, K6DPZ. At this time, we're going to take in check-ins. So if you've got a question or a comment for the net, give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW listening.
Leo, Dick, just want to say hello.
Hey, we got you, Rich. Anyone else check in after Rich? Give me your call letters and name right now.
Did you have a chance to go through the emails?
No, I did not. I'm sorry about that, Wes. All right, so we've got Rich and Wes so far to check in. Anyone else with a question or comment for the net, give me a call letters right now. K2LIW listening.
Answers.
We got you, Hal. Anyone else to check in with a question or comment? Please give me a call letters right now.
E2FKD.
Okay, I heard FKG. What was the prefix on that? Foxtrot Kilo Juliet. Please tell me the prefix and your name, sir. Go ahead. Mr. Foxtrot Kilo Juliet, number two. Well, what was the prefix net. Give me a call letter and name right now.
KD2FKD, Tom.
Looks like I had your name wrong before. Foxtrot Kilo Delta. Okay, KD2, I think it is, FKD. We got you, Tom. And Freddie, VBN, I think that your call letters are true, Freddie.
VBN.
Okay, we got Freddie, VBN. Alrighty, Rich, you were first. You're right ahead, N2EO, K2LIW.
If I may, can I get a message out to Joe?
Go right ahead, Joe. Here we go. John, you got it. KC2WGV, K2LIW.
Thank you, Dick. W2DMP, are you still out there, Joe?
W2BMP, I'm here, John.
Joe, just to let you know, if you can't get me on the radio, they do have my phone number listed there. Andy has it also, Eric. If you have to set up an appointment like this and you want to get me ahead of time, call me on my home phone anytime. Just get the number from somebody.
Roger that. Thanks so much, John. Dick, thanks very much. Sorry to interrupt, guys. 73, W2BMP, we're clear.
To you, Dick.
Okay, John and Joe. Rich next, N2EO. Go right ahead, Rich, K2LIW.
Okay, Dick, don't really have too much, just want to say hello, but you know, I appreciate the friendship we've had since about 1976 or 77, when you, myself, and Barry, N2MB, started out on 432 megahertz single sideband. Those days, we were using, the Echo 70s. I think you were running FM. I don't know what you were using at that time, but anyway, Dick, back to you. Just want to say hi. And to you.
Yeah, it was that old Kenwood, I think was the brand name. No, not Kenwood. What was it? The Echo 70, and it was being imported by a guy in California. KLM, I think it was. Yeah, KLM Echo 70, a tiny little rig. With a polar plexer, so to speak. In other words, it had a bunch of crystals in it that you pulled each one of those crystals to get every individual 10kc up the band, so to speak. But it did put out a medium quality single sideband signal. And that, I think it had 10 watts of output, that into a parallel kilowatt amplifier, into 16 Yagis on 432 and a 100-foot tower is what allowed me to talk to a guy in Greensboro, North Carolina. All of a sudden, I can't think of his K4, can't think of his call letters right now. Yes, in the very beginning, I did run narrowband FM on 6 meters, but way back in the dark ages. And so, all kinds of ham radio. There's 26 different kinds of ham radio. And that was one of the ones that we were experimenting with in those days. Eric, I know that you wanted to tell us something, or ask us something, so go right ahead. KE2EJ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Hi, Dick. How you doing? K2LIW, K2EJ. It's not really a simple question, but I'm looking for a little advice, actually. In the process of creating a spot antenna, let's call it a horizontally polarized spot antenna. We're looking at around 430 megahertz in that neighborhood, and I really can't decide what's the better approach and how do I calculate the geometry of slots. We could do it one of two ways. I mean, I could do it like we do with a broadcast antenna, which is essentially a series of dipoles behind a slot, which is one method. There's another method, which is essentially you create a collinear antenna, which you create in a cylinder the apertures, which would be the slot at a I think it's got to be a wave, a quarter of a wavelength away from the radiating element within sight. What are your thoughts, and what do you think the best approach to something like that is? KQRWK2.
For the last 15 or so years, maybe 20 years, the most famous ham radio slot antenna is being used as a beacon antenna, an omnidirectionally horizontally polarized beacon antenna for the guys on 10 gigahertz. They start off with a piece of 10 gigahertz waveguide, which is WR, WR number for the 10 gig waveguide. It's a waveguide that's about
92.
Is it again?
92.
Somebody said 92, and that number doesn't ring a bell. What's the size of the waveguide most often used on WR?
WR90, I think, Dick.
One, that's the one, WR90. It's a 9/10 of an inch wide by a little more, 0.45 inches high. I'm looking at a piece of it right now. You start off with that piece of waveguide, and you set it up as a vertical object. In other words, you're feeding the waveguide from the bottom, and you've got, something in the vicinity of a foot or so of this waveguide, and you have a bunch of vertical slots cut into the waveguide on the broad walls, on the forward broad wall and the backward broad wall. By properly positioning those slots and having them the right length, you end up with a pancake pattern on the horizon, fairly good for omnidirectional coverage, goes into all directions, and the slots themselves really represent the duality. In other words, your ordinary dipole antenna is a conductor in space, and all the space around it is insulator. And Mother Nature will allow you to do the opposite. Start off with a sheet of metal, which is conductive everywhere, and cut a slot in it, and so now you're doing the opposite. You've got a conduction everywhere in a place where there's not conduction. And the slot antenna, the duality of it compared to an ordinary dipole is that you end up with the exact same game, the exact same pattern. The only thing that's different is that a horizontal dipole gives you horizontal polarization. A vertical slot gives you horizontal polarization. So in other words, it gives you the opposite polarization. In the case of that waveguide-fed slot, the signal going down the center of the waveguide leaks into each one of those holes, so to speak, and when you set it up just right, you get essentially equal power into each one of those holes. So waveguide feeding it is the way it's done on 10 gigs.
Repeater, time out.
However, the way waveguide works is that at least one dimension, the WR90 waveguide happens to be 9/10 of an inch wide on a wavelength that's approximately 1 inch. So therefore, anything more than a half inch of width would propagate that signal as waveguide. In the case of 432, where the wavelength is 27 inches, your waveguide, if it was ordinary rectangular waveguide, would have to be a minimum of, let's call it 13 inches wide. That's if it's a rectangular waveguide. If it's circular, it's going to be a little bit more than that, probably 15 inches in diameter, if it's being waveguide fed. So ordinary waveguide that people buy and use on 432 is very rare. The only place that I've seen waveguide on 432 is the FPS-35 radar located out at Montauk Point. This is a huge rotary antenna, 135 feet wide, and it is fed with a piece of waveguide, which looks like a very large industrial ductwork. You know, the heating ductwork is what the waveguide looks like. That waveguide must be at least 15 inches wide that's being used out there. So, now, do you really have to feed it with waveguide? That's the conventional approach. Could you now put individual, start off with a sheet of metal that's the right diameter to keep you happy, put these vertical slots in it, and now, by way of a phasing harness, feeding a slot antenna by putting a piece of coax cable across it near the short-circuited end of one of these slots. If you put the center conductor on one side of the slot, the shield on the other side, you're feeding signal into that slot, and therefore making a phasing harness to feed all of your slots, that would work like a charm. That's probably the easiest way. Broadcast stations don't do it like that because they've got a much more severe requirement than you do, as I see it, Eric, and that is they have to obey.
Repeater, time out.
Let me find out why they say it's time and access. So.
Yeah, I'm guessing we've got a fairly short timer. Like, is it in the vicinity of 60 seconds, Eric? Go ahead.
I'm going to see what it says and reset it. If you remember, I've shown you life guide that I use at 520 megahertz. That stuff is big and heavy. But let me take care of the timer business. In a way, like on the World Trade Center, the way they did a couple of stations, it's basically a slot with a series of dipoles behind it.
Quick comment for Eric. Go ahead, John. Eric, don't forget, the consistency is the beep has been changed to this net beep. That could be the same issue as the beep being turned off when it goes into different lines in the program.
No, I'll find out in a second.
So there's a zillion ways that you can see in the individual slots. One of the more severe requirements you've got with a broadcast antenna, Eric, is that you have to obey a very tight specification with reference to loop delay distortion. In other words, the 6 megacycle of bandwidth of a television broadcast transmitter must have essentially equal phase characteristics across that whole 6 megacycles. We amateurs don't have that severe requirement. Therefore, some of the designs for broadcast antennas use much more elaborate... They use much more elaborate feeding techniques in order to try to achieve equal group delay distortion across the 6 megacycles, and are probably trying to achieve something like 1 degree of phase matching across the whole 6 megacycles of the radiated signal. And therefore, they tend to use much more elaborate techniques for exciting the slots. You could do it with a relatively simple power divider going into individual pieces of coax cable. Each individual piece of coax cable is feeding a signal across the appropriate slot. Make those pieces of coax cable the right length. That will create the phase characteristic you want of the antenna. You could slant the phase so that the beam out of the antenna is slightly tilted up above the horizon or below the horizon. There's lots of ways you could go. The slot antenna, let me drop.
Hang on a second, we're going to reset.
Roger.
RCQN repeater controller V6.03. The time is 8:20 p.m. The time is 8:20 p.m.
Okay. I heard you say, go ahead, pick it up, Jake. I heard you on the input, even though I didn't hear you coming through the machine, Eric. So, lots and lots of ways of feeding an antenna. And of the 5,000 kinds of antennas, the whole series of antennas called slots, which are a subset of what's called frequency selective surfaces. There's various ways that you can take a sheet of conducting material, cut various shapes of holes in the material, slots, crosses, diamonds, and whatever. And if you read that book by Ben Rich, I think his name is, on the subject of frequency selective surfaces, you'll get a lot of information. But there is a specific chapter of every one of the issues of the Antenna Engineering Handbook. Antenna Engineering Handbook was first published by Dr. Henry Jasek in 1982, McGraw-Hill. Then it got updated. The next edition was done by Jasek and Johnson. The third edition is by Johnson. The fourth edition is by Balakis. But any one of those issues of a well-equipped library will have a copy of the Antenna Engineering Handbook. And if you read the section on slotted antennas, and by the way, the later and later editions, let me drop. But the later and later issues of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, the section on slotted array antennas and slotted antennas becomes larger and larger with more and more pictures, more and more data as to how to build slotted antennas. You Google the word slotted antenna, or you look at the fourth edition of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, and you're going to find a lot of information, and it must be a healthy 30 pages on that subject, with various ways of feeding it, where various ways of getting amplitude taper, phase taper, and the control of the antenna pattern, the omnidirectional, the polarization characteristics, circular polarization. There's a lot of antenna information there. Ham radio operators, except for the guys on 10 gigs, they've made extremely little use of slotted antennas. And the most elaborate slotted antenna I know about, this will be the last I'll tell you, the array of slots that are on a great big flat plate, and there's a whole bunch of rows and columns of slots on a flat plate that's used as a radar transmitting antenna, the phased array, slotted array thing, which is used on many aircraft radar systems. The design procedure that goes into one of those, I'll warn you, to do it properly seems to require a tremendous amount of computer networking, computer modeling is the word I'm looking for. I'm wondering why you've chosen as a 432 antenna, Eric, a slotted array as opposed to a more conventional array of dipoles. The slots themselves tend not to have any more efficiency, any more control of pattern. To set up an array of slots requires, let me drop, a very large sheet of metal in order to, many wavelengths in diameter, many wavelengths high, in order to set up the network for setting up the slotted array, where it gives you no advantage out of using more conventional wire-like dipoles. I'm a little curious as to why you've chosen that approach, what you believe is the advantage for your particular application. KE2EJ, KQRIW in the TechNet.
KQRIW, KE2EJ. Now, there's a couple of reasons. One, the major reason is bandwidth. I'm looking for the ability to be resonant across 6 megahertz. And by the way, the way that they did it at World Trade, the series of plots, the series of actually cross dipoles behind it to a rather complex phasing harness, but the thing was about, I guess it was about 40 feet worth of real estate and a 360-degree arrangement, so... Actually, if you ever come over, I'll show you a video of them actually taking the thing apart. You can see how it was constructed. It was also done for the ability to create a 1-degree downward tilt. But I'm interested in making an antenna that's relatively consistent, not, you know, flat across 6 megahertz. It didn't have to be an SWR 1.1-to-1, but consistent across the bandwidth, if you follow my meaning.
Yes, I follow your meaning, Eric. And you seem to start off with the belief that the duality of Mother Nature, where an ordinary dipole is a conductor in an insulating world, whereas a slotted antenna is a conducting world with a slot in it, you seem to have been led to believe that the slot has greater bandwidth than the wire dipole. It does not. And when it comes to making a dipole broadband, if you read Chapter 4 of every one of the issues of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, where they cover monopole and dipole-like structures, and you look at the so-called Brown and Woodward curves, the so-called second, well, either of the Brown and Woodward curves, the first ones, which I think are diagram 4-3 and 4-4 in every issue, and by the way, you can see the Brown and Woodward curve by going to, if you don't have a copy of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, you go to the bottom of the page on whiskeyalpha1mikebravoalpha.org, whiskeyalpha1mikebravoalpha.org, that's the microwave site of Dr. Tom Williams. Go to the bottom of that page, and you'll see dipole matching information by KQRIW. you read those 1,500 words, and you look at those two diagrams. But when you look at the two diagrams, one diagram is a plot of resistance versus length of the dipole. The other curve is the reactance versus length of the dipole. And there's a whole lot of curves on each individual plot. Each one of those curves represent a piece of wire that's a different diameter. And if you make the wire of the dipole larger and larger in diameter, and at 432 you can do that, you'll get a lot more bandwidth. Also, when you're looking at the Chapter 4 of Antenna Engineering Handbook, and you now look beyond the first two curves of Brown and Woodward, Brown and Woodward has a whole lot of curves that are moving in the direction of a double conical antenna. And the double conical antenna, let me drop it.
Repeater, time out.
Of a triangular shaped piece sheets of metal that constitute the dipole would give you more than enough bandwidth. I'll admit that it's a fair amount of sheet metal in the wind as far as wind loading concerned, but it's going to be a hell of a lot less wind loading than a slotted array would, because it takes a certain number of wavelengths, so to speak, of sheet metal around a slot in order for the slot to work correctly. So this very large tube of conductor for a slotted array would be a much, much larger wind load than an array of dipoles. But if you're smart enough in the way to use dipoles, you can get omnidirectional pattern at each elevation level. How many elevation levels you use determines how narrow is your vertical beamwidth. And the dipoles themselves, there's ways you can construct the dipoles to get more than enough bandwidth. There is one other technique you ought to consider. Let me drop.
That was going to be my question, because the more I sat, the narrower the beamwidth is going to become.
Absolutely, and that's a very predictable characteristic. One of the universal rules of a antenna is the aperture that's doing the emitting of the signal. The real estate of that aperture determines the bandwidth. In the case of a horn antenna, you tell me how many wavelengths wide is the horn, and I'll tell you exactly how many degrees is the horizontal beamwidth of that horn. The magic number is 70 degrees. Take 70 degrees divided by the number of wavelengths of width, and it'll tell you exactly what the beamwidth is going to be. If you made your horn antenna, I'm just using it as an example, if you made it 10 wavelengths wide, you divide 10 into 70, you'll end up with 7. A 10 wavelength wide horn will have very close to 7 degrees of horizontal beamwidth. In your case, your aperture is a vertical stack of dipoles. You tell me how many wavelengths high is that stack of dipoles, divide that number of wavelengths of height of your stack of dipoles into 70 degrees, it'll tell you exactly what the vertical beamwidth is. So if you stack your vertical dipoles 10 wavelengths high, it would have a vertical beamwidth of 7 degrees. Very predictable phenomenon. KE2EJ, K2RIW, go ahead, Eric.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Now, I had pondered doing something like that. Well, you think of a, not a turnstile, but I'm trying to think of the name of it. They're basically flat wire antennas that look like a cloverleaf, and you could stack them quarter wave apart from each other. Eventually, it gets pretty tall if you want it to. Increase the gain, but you're also going to decrease the beamwidth in which the antenna operates. So, now, let's say I did something like that, and I wanted to put a little tilt on it. What would you recommend?
Yeah, a vertical stack of cloverleafs, a vertical stack of loops, a vertical stack of dipoles, any of these elements, when you make it multiple wavelengths high, and usually your elements are in the vicinity of a half-wave space. If you space them greater than that, then you have only partially filled aperture, so to speak. You got holes in the aperture. So half-wavelength of vertical stacking in that vicinity, and if you fed them all exactly in phase with each other with your phasing harness, the beam would be exactly on the horizon. If you taper the phase, in other words, if you use slightly longer pieces of coax, as you go higher and higher in elevation on the array, every phased array steers the beam in the direction of the delay. So in the example I just gave, you have slightly longer coax cable going to each one of the slots, each one of the dipoles as you go up vertically. That would give you a phase delay, vertical distribution, that would tilt the beam up, which is the opposite of what you want to do. So therefore, you're going to go the other way around. You're going to use slightly shorter pieces of coax cable, or slightly leading phase as you go higher and higher, or lagging phase as you go down. The rate at which you tilt the beam versus the rate at which you taper the phase of feeding the element, very well controlled characteristic, very predictable, works very well with computer modeling. You don't even have to use computer modeling. You go to the correct chapter of Antenna Engineering Handbook, it'll tell you how to do that too. Every well-equipped library that has a technical section will have some number of those editions of the Antenna Engineering Handbook. Lots and lots of ways you can get a hold of those, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
2RIW, K2EJ. Well, the next time I I go to 50th Street, I'm just going to follow it. It's just something I've been thinking about doing, and I did some experimenting while I've been snowed in the house, and which is not really the place to do it, but just a little proof of concept in terms of ideas of how to actually make it, so. Alright, well, I just wanted your opinion on how to proceed, so to speak. I haven't really decided how I'm going to do it, but, you know, it's just something that I've been tinkering with because I've got something that would be, if you would consider it in the order of amateur television, it would be useful for that, but that's not where I'm going. I'm doing some digital stuff. It's a DSP type of modem that I created, and it's different than most of the stuff that's out there. And, you know, I want to do a little proof of concept before I show it to some other folks, and maybe it eventually become a mode of transmission. All right, Dick, move right along. You've given me plenty to think about. K2RIW, K2J.
Yeah, I should tell you, Eric, that ham radio operators have made very, very little use of phased arrays. The closest they come to it is a so-called station master antenna. Sometimes they homebrew those. Usually they buy it as a commercial product. But that is a kind of vertically stacked collinear phased array antenna. In other words, by the method by which you feed all those individual elements, the length of the coax cable between them determines the phase distribution. And once you know the phase distribution, there's all kinds of ways you can model what the antenna pattern will look like with reference to vertical tilting up or tilting down of that pancake pattern you get out of a vertical stack of any kind of antennas. You're going to get a pancake pattern out to the horizon. And if you tilt that pancake upward, it becomes sort of a concave cone upward, or you can tilt it downward. It becomes a little bit like I can't easily describe the object if you draw the three-dimensional antenna pattern. But the phased arrays, not many hams have used them, simply because the subject of phase delay, phase measurement, in other words, having two traces on an oscilloscope, and you've got a sine wave on each one of them, and one sine wave is a little bit shifted to the right compared to the other, which really means the one that shifted to the right is the one that's delayed. It behaves kind of backwards, but the phase characteristics of two separate signals, and just the word phase itself and phase measurement, sort of gives an awful lot of ham radio operators a pretty tough time. All right, we're going to go over to Tom next. Hope you got a nice strong signal tonight, Tom. Kilo Delta 2, Foxtrot Kilo Delta, K2RIW in the check net. You've got it, Tom.
Hi, KD2 FKD. I just have a simple question.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Okay, I heard that you said, Tom, on the input. Tom is asking a question about how do you get more isolation in a relay. Relay that you use for transmit-receive characteristics is what I think he's talking about. Stand by a second while I try something here.
I'm in the process of setting up the alternator. I'll let you know when it's ready.
Roger that. Looks like we're going to need it pretty soon. I think the person is running back and forth on the expressway. As soon as the alternator is ready to go, I'll let you go. I'll switch over to it. Transco is one of the respected brand names in ham radio available antennas, often on the flea market, at fairly nice prices. The slight disadvantage of most of them run on 24 volts. You'd like it to run on 12 volts, but that's a minor detail. Transco, TRANSCO, is a company in, I think it's Camarillo, California, that makes a very, very nice antenna relay, which has in the vicinity of 60 decibels of isolation, single pole, double probe, and when you switch it in between those two poles, the other pole is more than 60 decibels suppressed. That's a million to one power ratio. It's a real coaxial relay. It's a Y-shaped object with type N connectors on it. That's the Cadillac of antenna relays. The less than the relays that were made by Transco is another brand name, very good brand name. Transco got purchased by, I can't think of the brand name, a very popular ham radio antenna, ham radio relay, where there's a very simple read inside that switches from between one and the other of the two output connectors. That particular read type of coax relay doesn't have anywhere near as much isolation. And by the way, there are sexy ways that you can put an electronic circuit of stubs of coaxial cable on the outside of your relay at one particular fixed frequency. You can force it to have a whole lot of isolation by way of a network of coaxial cables you can put on the outside. But that's a technique that only works at one frequency at a time, Tom. You probably want to do this across the whole ham band of 80 to 10 meters.
Repeater, timeout.
My guess is you're trying to do this across the whole ham band of 80 to 10 meters. Is that true, Tom? And Tom, you have no trouble getting over this guy. You just go right ahead. Kilo Delta 2, Foxtrot, Kilo Delta, K2RIW. You got it, Tom.
What I have here is a new TYT 4-band radio, and I have a separate SWR meter for VHF, UHF, and another one for the 6-meter and 10-meter bands on the radio. And my I noticed that my meters, my both meters work. You know, they're in fact, one of them's pinning the needle when I'm not even on that, when I'm not even switched to that meter. So I'm thinking that this switch is not working very well.
Yeah, the what separates the men from the boys in relays, Tom, is called isolation. And if you're buying a well-recognized brand name of transmit receive relay or single pole double throw relay, how much isolation it has in decibels, is the usual way it's rated, of the unselected port. If you select port number one, and you'd like port number two to be 60 decibels isolated, a good relay by Transco, among other brands, Transco and, I can't remember the other company I mentioned. Oh, yeah, Transco is one of them. Can't think of the other brand name right now. But if you look at the isolation report, that will tell you what you're going to get ahead of time. 20 decibels of isolation, I would call it fairly poor. 60 decibels of isolation, I would call it extremely good. So now you know what you're looking for. And once you know the model number and brand name of the relay, and you look it up by a Google search, usually the manufacturer will tell you the isolation rating of that relay. So I wonder if that information is helpful. Let's hope that we don't time out, but even if we do, I continue on the input and I'll repeat what you say, Tom. KD2, FKD.
Repeater, time out.
I'm going to look online right now and check out this Transco. Thanks for your help. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Google the word Transco Y. Transco dash Y for Yankee. Transco Y. A very popular antenna for the last 40 or 50 years. Lots and lots of hams have been using them on the microwave frequencies like that. 2 meters, 432, 1296. The relay itself has rated performance up to 10 gigahertz. Rated in isolation performance up to 10 gigahertz and then wave ratio performance. Brand new, the relay is kind of pricey, but on the surplus market, hams have found lots and lots of ways of buying those at very nice prices on the surplus market. Quite often numbers like $20 and $30 for a Transco Y. And when it comes to isolation, you can't do any better. A Transco Y relay can take a kilowatt of power, pipe end connectors, insertion loss is probably 1 or 2 tenths of a decibel, and across most of the frequency range you care about, isolation is 60 decibels. That's a million to one power ratio. So, among the hands who need lights of isolation and a single pole double throw relay, that by far is the most popular brand. There must be 10,000 hands out there using that exact relay on 432 and above frequencies. And
Nothing's stopping you from using it at lower frequencies. Use it at 160 meters if you want to. There's nothing wrong with taking an electromechanical relay. Let me drop. Nothing wrong with taking an electromechanical relay and using it at a lower frequency than where it's rated for highest performance. Electromechanical relays always work better and better at lower frequencies. Any relay that has marginal isolation only happens at the upper end of the frequency region. So, research. As you do that research, Tom, please come back and tell us what you find. 82 FKD for any further comments. Speak to RIW in the tech net.
I appreciate your help. Thanks a lot. I gotta check it out now. This is KD2FKD.
Very fine. You can't do very well, Tom. I know that Freddie, VBN, would like to transmit now. Under these particular conditions, I think we're gonna have to delay you, Freddie. Freddie, give it a try. You might be in just the right position and you come through very well. Freddie, VBN, give us a brief transmission. Let's see how well you're coming through. Freddie, VBN, go right ahead. K2LIW. If you're in there, Freddie, we're not hearing you. Once again, anybody who's hearing these calls that shouldn't be there. Tell us how strong is the signal, where you were located at the time, and report it to RFI and Limon data bus. There is at least one or four very destructive individuals out there that like making it so difficult for people. Guys will use with a handy talkie when they get real close, when they're standing in front of the house where a guy
guy is doing the transmitting, for instance, and you remove the rubber duck from your handy-talky, and you can still hear the guy, quite possibly you're within 100 or 200 feet of him, and by rotating your body where the handy-talky is north and his house is south, so your body is acting like a shield, and the signal disappears, and then you rotate your body so you're on the other side of the handy-talky, and the signal comes back, you can do direction finding along those lines. That's one of many tricks that the fox hunters have used in the past. I'm pretty sure that for the time being, we're not going to be able to hear Freddy VBN above this noise. So why don't we go over to the mailbag at this time, John, and then we'll come back to Freddy. Freddy, don't give up. If this guy gets a little bit tired running back and forth on the expressway, and he stops doing it, then we'll pick you up, Freddy. KC2WGB, see how well you're able to come through on the upper frequency, John, and tell us what you found in the mailbag these days. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick. All everyone on the net. Are you copying, son?
Copying you loud and clear, Paul. Please proceed. Said Paul, I meant John. I gotta change your name, John. You got it, John.
Say, Cookie. Call me Cookie. First of all, I have a quick comment on the gentleman who was just discussing the meter issue. Could he not make a stub, a tune stub, with a variable capacitor, which should give him enough range to quiet down that one bird that's singing away on the wrong frequency? Is that possible?
Absolutely, John. You're here. Once you understand how a transmit-receive relay or a single-pole double-throw relay or a double-pole double-throw relay, any of these relays, once you understand how they work, they all have some kind of electromechanical switch inside. It's usually a solenoid that you put the 12 or 24 volts on it. It sucks in a small piece of metal that moves a reed, and the reed that used to catch contact number one goes over to contact number two. And there is a certain spacing of that reed inside, which means that the contact, you're not making contact to. That your own meter will say that you're on contact number two at this time, and by getting many, many megohms on contact number one, you'll find out there's no connection there. Well, no connection DC-wise is very, very different than no connection RF-wise. Any two objects that are close together in space with no real electrical contact have a certain amount of capacitive coupling between them. Therefore, that's the so-called isolation requirement or isolation measurement. And knowing the physical layout of the relay and knowing how capacitance operates and what frequency you're on, and you know how to calculate capacitive reactance, you could use relatively simple mathematics to make a ballpark prediction as to what is the capacitance coupling between the unused contact and your used contact. Once you know the magnitude of that capacitance, there's various ways you can set up circuits on the outside of the relay to cancel that capacitance. You can resonate that capacitor with the right size of an inductor that's in parallel with that capacitor. And the word in parallel will scare you at first. Let me drop. It doesn't mean you have to really climb inside the relay and put a real inductor across that gap. You could do it on the outside of the relay by setting up various circuits with coaxial stubs, endovirector diodes, and a variable capacitor diode in a small box. There's various ways that you can take a single-pole double-throw relay of poor performance on your particular one single frequency and put the right kind of a network on the outside, and on that frequency, you can make the isolation almost as high as you want. However, the problem, as I see it, John, is that what Tom is trying to do is to create a high-performance relay on probably a whole lot of frequencies at once. His particular rig, I think, operates on 80 through 10 meters or 80 through 2 meters, and so he wants the relay to operate on a whole lot of frequencies, one at a time. Now life gets a little bit more complicated. In that particular circumstance, I'd recommend he go and buy a so-called Transco Y. Transco-Y for Yankee. That's the most popular brand among the serious microwave enthusiasts. And although it's quite a few hundred dollars for one of those brand new, on the surplus market, The average ham usually gets his hands on one of those for in the vicinity of $20 or $30 or so. KC2WGB, K2RIW, the tech man.
KC2WGB. Oh, very good. All right. All right. Okay. Got a young ham here who's working on power supplies, Dick, and he wants to understand the difference between bridge rectification and just a simple full-wave rectifier with two diodes. Why does the voltage increase on the bridge rectifier? If you could help him out with that. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Okay, nice question. In the case of a single source of 60 cycle signal and one single diode into a capacitor as a half wave rectifier, that's pretty easy to understand. When you want a full wave rectifier, it's almost always done with a transformer, and the transformer is a center tapped secondary winding. Usually the center tap of the transformer is grounded. The two separate ends of the transformer go to two separate diodes of equal polarity. The two diodes come together at the filter capacitor, and that is a full wave rectifier. On one half of the 60 cycle wave, the upper diode on your center tap, center grounded transformer, the upper diode is the one that's going to be doing the action on the half of the sine wave. On the second half of the sine wave, the bottom diode is the one that's got the positive voltage, and it's going to be doing the conducting. So each half of the sine wave is conducting into those two diodes one at a time, and it's called full wave. Let me drop. Now, you'll notice that in order to hook up the transformer for full wave rectification, you're grounding the center tap. At each instant of time, either the upper half of the center tap winding, secondary winding, is being used, or the lower half. Only one half is being used at a time, and therefore, of the total voltage that the transformer secondary winding is capable of giving you, peak to peak of upper lead versus lower lead, not using the center tap, you're only using half of it at any one time. If, by comparison, you now use a bridge rectifier consists of not two diodes, but four diodes. They usually, you could set it up as four individual diodes with proper wiring if you desire, or you could buy this little square device that's got four leads coming out of it, which is a bridge rectifier. The way you set up a bridge rectifier is now you're using the whole secondary winding all at once. You don't use the center tap at all anymore. So therefore, the raw voltage you're getting from your transformer is twice as big. And therefore, the four diodes in the bridge rectifier still, no matter which lead is positive and which lead is negative, it gives you the full winding voltage, twice the voltage, therefore you get twice the voltage out of a bridge rectifier. If in my example now, I've got a transformer where the secondary winding has 200 volts across the whole winding. Let me drop. I got 200 volts across the whole winding, and the center tap is grounded. Therefore, I've got 100 volts each side of center tap, and with ordinary full-wave rectification with two diodes, I'll get 100 volts out of that power supply per se. In reality, the peak voltage is a little bit higher than the RMS. You'll get as much as 141 volts, but we won't go there. RMS-wise, it's 100 volts on each half of the winding. If now, instead of using two diodes and a full-wave rectifier, I use a bridge network of four diodes, and I use two outer windings of the transformer. It's a 200-volt secondary transformer. Center tap is usually grounded. When I'm using it as a bridge rectifier network, usually I do not use the center tap at all, although there's a fancy way you can do that